Greetings, travelers.
Greetings, travelers. It is the Monster May.
Oh, I like that. It was almost Monster Mash. I like that.
I swear if you do not say Monster May correctly, Mark, I'm going to lose my crap.
We're in Monster May. I love it. So
I know. You just keep changing the name to different things.
I just, I like saying the mayhem of Monster May. It's fun. So it's.
My gosh. Oh my gosh. Okay. So this is kind of an exciting episode we have for today.
Yes.
We're going to cut all the normal breaking news and all that stuff, mainly because I don't have any, but mostly because of our amazing guests we have today.
Yeah. This is pretty epic. I'm very happy that this wonderful person decided to join us and willing to put up with our nonsense for an hour. So.
Well, we'll see if that's true for an hour. You're being very ambitious, but we're going to try. We're going to try. Do you want to do a mini introduction before he does some?
As many as I think I can. This man is an award-winning author, including a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Bram Stoker Awards, amongst many other celebrated works. One of my favorite books of all time, we did it for our inaugural book club for Patreon, was Crota, and that is written by the amazing person who is our guest today, Al Goingback. So,
welcome, Al.
Hey guys, how you doing? Thank you for having me on the show.
Absolutely, we're great because you're here. I was so excited because I remember getting Crota from you. We met in at a convention the first time, and I got Crota, and I didn't sleep after I read it, so it was cool. And then they were like, "Let's do it for a book club," and I was like, "Cool, I don't get to sleep again. Let's definitely do that."
Crota is such a lovable monster. I mean, I've had so many people really enjoy that book and sleep with the lights on. So I did my job on that story.
You absolutely did. And I have to say, so the second time I listened to it on audiobook, because I was like, I've read it, I'm going to listen to it on audiobook during the day when it's not dark. And yeah, that was much, much better for my mental health. But so why don't I jumped in with that? But why don't you tell everyone a little bit about you?
Okay, I've been writing professionally for over 30 years, which means I'm older than dirt. I started out doing martial arts magazines for a magazine, martial arts articles for magazines like Black Belt and Taekwondo Times, but it was too much work and I had to get a photographer involved every time. So I switched to doing fiction. I started with short stories and with the children's books. I've done poems. I've done quite a few novels. I've even ghostwritten for a Hollywood celebrity. And that book was nominated for one of the biggest awards in the country, but I can't tell anybody about it.
The joys of ghostwriting. Yep.
Ghostwriting. They pay me to keep my mouth shut, but it's really frustrating when you see somebody else up there on TV waving the book around on talk shows and stuff.
Yeah.
Then they're done that. And again, you had the same problem I had trying to get a literary agent, because you change genres so much that it's hard to pin you down.
I get bored. I mean, I was doing the novels, and I was doing a novel a year, and I walked away from it for a while and tried my hands at Hollywood. And I found out the people in Hollywood are crazier than the people in New York with publishing. I got all the way up to almost having a script produced with a major studio and having George Romero on board to direct. And then the previous writer's strike came along and nixed the deal. So I went back to doing books again.
That's actually kind of true in the publishing world in general, is that there's a lot of weirdness. And if you get the right thing, you're great. But if you don't, then you can go down a ridiculous superhighway.
Well, it's frustrating. I've been like the world's most unlucky writer. My first novel, Crota, sold to Donald I. Fine Books. At the time, Donald I. Fine Books was being bought by Penguin Putnam. Donald I. Fine, the man, was dying from cancer, and the editor I was assigned with quit to be a real estate agent. So the book was orphaned before it ever came out. There was no follow-up, no talk about a sequel. But when I went to the Stoker Awards, because it was nominated for both Best First Novel and Best Novel, I sat next to the editor from Signet, and I kept telling him, hey, there's no paperback deal for this book. And when I won the award, I set the trophy in front of him. I said, now let's talk about a paperback deal. He said, have your agent call me. And the guy ended up buying four books from me. So it was great.
Hey, that's one way to do it.
And you've written for both the big major comic book publishers, both Marvel and DC.
I went through DC, had a writer's training program for comic writers. It was a very unique. It was I can't remember exactly. I think it was like a 12-week course taught by Scott Snyder, who does Batman. And it was, I got selected for that. And, you know, they were teaching us how to do comics. So I did a Poison Ivy comic for them. And then I did a Werewolf by Night for Marvel, which I loved doing it because Werewolf by Night was what introduced me to the comic world. I was a huge fan as a kid.
Yeah, Werewolf by Night's one of my favorites. That and Tomb of Dracula were my introduction. I love those. So yeah, well, besides Famous Monsters of Filmland, but yeah, that's.
Hey, I'm representing with the shirt. I'm wearing my Famous Monsters.
That's why I had to bring it up.
That magazine probably, if it wasn't Famous Monsters of Filmland, I wouldn't have been a writer, because when I got my very first allowance at the age of 9, it was 50 cents. I lived in rural America. The closest town had a population of 1,200 people. There was no bookstores, no toy stores, but they had a Rexall drugstore that had a magazine rack. And I walked in, and there was Famous Monsters of Filmland on the stand. So this little 9-year-old kid picked up a magazine, instantly fell in love with horror movies and monsters, and it changed my life.
There we go.
Well, I was going to ask you, what got you into wanting to write horror? Because it's a particular thing, horror. So what somehow drew you to that?
I was raised on horror. I mean, I read Edgar Rice Burroughs and H.P. Lovecraft and Edgar Allan Poe, and Famous Monsters film and Vampirella, Creepy, all the horror comics. I never read superheroes. I watched all the monster movies and stuff. I was a little kid in the country who used to say, "Dear God, let me see Bigfoot. Let me see a UFO." And I would say this during the daytime. When night would come around, that forest get dark, and I'd hear the creatures through in the woods through my bedroom window, I'd always be like, "Dear God, remember what I asked for earlier? Not at night. Never at night." So I was big into horror. I listened to CBS Radio Mystery Theater, and my grandmother lived in a trailer behind us, and she was kind of a paranoid delusionist, and she always thought there was murders in the woods. So every day she'd tell me about the screams and the murders taking place behind her little trailer, which really inspired me. So I wanted to do horror for the biggest time, since I was little.
Oh, wow. Grandma's like, people are dying back here. That had to be amazingly interesting.
Well, Crota was inspired by an incident happened in the summer of, I think it was 73. The house in Crota and the cemetery are real places. My aunt lived in a house across from the cemetery at the edge of a forest. And one summer, us kids were not allowed to go outside and play after dark because there was something that was screaming. And they heard it, and we didn't know what it was. This is an area where supposedly no wolves, no black panthers, no cougars, no bear. And so, but we stayed in shock. We didn't know what this thing was. And my cousin took me out in the woods one day during the daylight and showed me this oak tree. And on this oak tree, there were claw marks that reached about 8 feet up, all the way down to the ground. And they were about 2 inches deep, where something had clawed this tree. And that inspired Crota right there. I said, I got to do a monster story set in the woods where it starts out at the cemetery.
Wow. With Crota, did you do research? I'm going to use all my words, I promise, travelers. Did you do research into legends and stuff? Because the interesting thing about Crota is people have now adopted this as a cryptid and talk about it like it is absolutely 100% a real thing. And I know you've been mentioning games and stuff where you're like, I made that up. You need to give me credit.
They haven't adopted it. They've ripped it off really bad. I made up Crota completely out of my own imagination, but I surrounded it with legends and folklore and cryptid stuff. So just about every reviewer who wrote a review on it says it's a real Native American legend. It's not. It's made up. So I've had people come out with their own books. I've had a billion-dollar gaming company come out with a Crota's Lair extension pack. I can't go after them because they got $1 billion in the bank, and I don't. They have better lawyers than I do. More recently, a podcast was posted on Amazon where the people are encouraging people to use the Crota to come out with their own game systems and stories. So, yeah, they've been using it a lot. Everybody thinks it's a real legend.
Well, you know,
it's powerful. It is.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is me and Mark talk about Topas all the time, and I'm like, they're putting an awful lot of energy into the Crota. They're going to manifest it. They're not going to like it if they do, because that doesn't happen to be like, I'm not saying Bigfoot's cute and cuddly. Bigfoot can be very dangerous, but Crota's a whole other level of violence and death and maiming and all sorts of stuff. So let's be careful bringing that tulpa into existence.
I actually had a couple in North Florida at a powwow, Chambers powwow, up in the Ocala area, approach me about the crota. And they wanted to know if it was a real monster, a real legend. And I'm like, why? And they said, well, we saw it. I'm like, you saw it? And they said, yeah, we saw it in the Ocala National Forest. I said, what do you mean you saw it? Then they're like, well, we didn't see it, but we felt its presence. It's a real thing, isn't it? And it broke my heart to tell these people, like, no, it's made up. But then I explained, well, there's other stuff in the Ocala National Forest. There's sightings of skunk apes and stuff. So I said, maybe you saw a skunk ape, but they believed it was real. There was another incident where the man wrote me, he was in Jacksonville, Florida, on a country road, and his truck broke down. And then it was nighttime, and he had the hood up working on the truck, and the crickets stopped chirping. And he knew it was the crota, and he ran in the truck, dived into the cab, and locked the doors. So you can't beat that when people think it's a real monster and it's coming for them.
Yeah, that's Martin Booger area up there. So
yeah, well, I was going to say it's he at least did the smart thing of getting out of the way instead of like, you know, it would be a good plan. Let's go investigate. I'm like, you are every horror movie that's ever been written. What are you doing? And then another thing I think is, oh my gosh, I almost lost my train of thought. That's really interesting is I feel like if anybody came to me and said, I think I saw crota, I'd be like, no, you wouldn't be here if you saw crota. Like that's that wouldn't be a thing. You wouldn't be here to explain to me how you think you saw it. Because literally one person survived seeing it. Well, technically two, but in the book, I'm like, yeah, no, that's so funny to me.
Well, the kill scenes are the most fun in the book. I mean, I had so much time, good times ripping people apart in that story. I mean, it's a monster romp by a monster kid at heart. That's all it is. It's designed to be 2 hours of entertainment on a flight, an airplane flight. Or if you're stuck on a bus, that's all crota is good for. It keeps your mind off everything.
That's why it's one of my favorite books. I can just tune out and enjoy the spookiness and the gore and just, but also that it's a good solid action story. And I see it on the screen in my mind, and it's it'll never be adapted properly because in my head, I've already made the multi-million dollar budget film of this. And then you followed it up with some other amazing books. One of my personal favorites, if you're a Florida person, you've got to read this because everybody goes to St. Augustine. So you have to read Al's book, Breed.
Breed is about a creature from basically another dimension that used to exist in this world. And it's come back through a portal that somebody accidentally opened and is trying to breed. It's trying to reestablish its race. So Breed was fun because I wanted to see how far I could push the boundaries with the publisher because there's some really gross scenes in there. I wanted to see what I could get away with. And basically, I found out I can get away with anything. They didn't care. But the story is kind of funny. I don't want to give away too much, but it was kind of supposed to have a happy ending and romantic. And I saw a vision of it not having that. And I thought it was funny to change it. But I didn't breed. I never really described the creature details until I get to the end because I never saw it when I was writing it. I got done writing the last chapter and I went in and took a shower. While taking a shower, I actually saw a vision of it. So I ran back in the office and typed up what it looked like. But up until that point, I never saw it in my mind.
That was one of the best things about crota is you leave so much to the imagination on that.
It's scarier. That's like Jaws. Jaws, it's like the only movie that ever scared me when I was younger. I was in the military and saw it. And I freaked out with the opening scene of the woman being drugged through the water because you couldn't see the creature. You couldn't see Jaws, the shark. Yeah. And you wondered what would go through your mind at that time. So I took a tip from Spielberg that less is best. So I just didn't describe crota in details. I didn't describe the creature Breed in details. So I wanted the readers to fill it in with their own imagination.
And you filled it with tons of St. Augustine references in that one. And that was where I was introduced to the legend of Lily and Lily's room before I even went there for my first trip to St. Augustine. So I was like, oh gosh, I gotta stay at the St. Francis Inn.
Well, I went to St. Augustine. I knew nothing about it. All I knew about St. Augustine, that's where they took the school kids for their school trips. I mean, and I went to St. Augustine, and I was messing around the Tallis Model Cemetery late at night around midnight. I got on the backside because the business left the gate open. I put a 35-millimeter Pentax camera against the fence and took a couple shots. And in the one picture, there's this green beam of light coming down and hitting this crypt, this above-ground grave, and there's no light in the area at the time. And standing in this green beam of light is a woman. and she's wearing an old style wedding dress, like an 1800s wedding dress. And you see the curl of her hair. You see the half veil she's wearing. She's facing the grave, but her eyes are looking right at me. And she looks like a corpse. You can see her, but you can see through her. And it blew me away. So I started asking people about this. They told me that a lot of people have seen what they call the bride. Well, this woman died a week before her wedding, and she was buried in her bridal gown. And this blew me away. So I started researching St. Augustine, the hauntings and ghosts. I said, I got to do a book set here. And I've sat down with the city council members. I've sat down with the former chief of police, with the mayor, and they all have ghost stories. So I had it included in Breed, and people use Breed as a ghost hunting book, find its spots. The only one they can't find is the one restaurant at the inn, because I made that up. And it gets them frustrated because they're trying to find it all the time.
Oh, everything else is so good. I'll admit, I was one of those guys going, all right, I found this, I found that. Where's this one?
I had a friend, I did a signing up there, and some friends wanted to see it. So I took them around to different locations, and we went to the St. Francis Inn. And we're standing on the outside, and they took a picture of room 3A, which is Lily's room. And the shutters were closed, and they're like covered half the window, and the light was on. And they used a digital camera, and clear to bell on this freaking camera is a picture of a black woman. It has a turban around her head, and she's holding a black baby wrapped in a blanket. Oh. And it was Lily. And the story is about Lily's room is Lily dated the nephew of the guy that owned the place, and he was white. That didn't go over back in those days. And they sent her away, and he hung himself in the attic. I've always wondered, well, if he hung himself, why is she haunting that room? But she was sitting there in this picture holding a child. So she had his baby, and she's waiting for dad to come home. So it makes you wonder if they sent her away, or back in those days, did they kill her to shut it up? Because it was a very wealthy family. Yeah. But if the picture is clear as a bell and the shutters are closed. I was there when they took the photo. So there's no way anybody could have been in that window. It's an amazing photo.
Your picture of the bride, when you showed that to me, was, you know, just staggering.
She's spooky. I love the bride. I love St. Augustine. I haven't been back in a few years, but I need to get back up there again. They're talking about bringing Breed back near Cemetery Dance. So maybe I got an excuse to go back up to St. Augustine.
That'd be good.
Well, I don't think you ever need an excuse to go to St. Augustine. What I think is really interesting is that you obviously have something to your writing that people just believe you're writing. Like, believe the pieces of it. You know what I mean? Because a lot of writers get asked, and they go, oh, well, this was the inspiration, whatever. But apparently you write stuff and people are just like, that's a thing. This building's there. Yeah. This creature exists. It's a thing.
Well, it's always scarier when you believe it. That's why I love studying folklore. Because folklore is always scarier to me because it's not, oh, we're making up a story about a monster. It's Joe Smith from down the road, country road, saw a monster and this is what it looked like. So it's always scarier when it's folklore or what's supposed to be true. You know, true legends are always scary. There's so many places around America get some weird stuff. Mark's told me shared with me a lot of stories. And it's always more fascinating if there's that element of truth. Right. So when I write, I try to make it seem like these things are real so you can suspend disbelief.
I mean, and that's the best stories. I mean, that's always that they've got that grain of truth. And even the folklore, we find, oh, there's this grain of truth behind it all and everything. That's where you go, wow, that's power. That there's power in words, there's power in legends, power in folklore. And now your more recent book that, again, won another Bram Stoker Award, Coyote Rage. That one has one thing I think our producer Bo would be very interested in. You got some shifters in that, some shapeshifters.
Shapeshifters. Coyote Rage came about because I was reading up on skinwalkers and shapeshifters. I came across a passage where they were describing one about peeling their skin off, turning it inside out, and putting it back on. I said, whoa, it's not just that Lon Chaney easily shift. This has got to have to work to it. And that fascinated me. I said, well, you know, let me do some more research and tie in some legends and make up my own stuff and bring in Greenwood Cemetery. Just have some fun with it. So it's kind of a dark fantasy, but I do have the body count in there to go along with it.
Well, so I have a question. Let's talk a little bit because you've said Greenwood Cemetery a couple times. What is Greenwood Cemetery?
Greenwood Cemetery is a 100-acre cemetery in the heart of downtown Orlando. It dates back to 1880. The city took it over in 1890. There is between 70,000 and 80,000 burials there, including all the major mayors and, you know, famous people in Orlando. It's very haunted. there's a lot of dispossessed ghosts there. When Greenwood became a city cemetery, they closed all the other cemeteries in the city limits and moved the bodies there, but didn't give them stones. Also, the people who died at Sunland Mental Institution in Orlando are moved there, and they don't have any stones either, except the children. They've got a double row of stones. It's the only ones the state would give a stone to. We got victims of lynching people were there. A person who supposedly had her face bit off by the Lake Wales water monster, Lake Clinch. And it's got all this wonderful history. It's the highest location in Orlando and the lowest. I was caretaker there, a full-time caretaker there for 7.5 years. Been out there on property lots of times by myself, day and night. And I have seen full body apparitions walk up to me and disappear. I mean, you know, not expected in broad daylight. One time I was working, I looked up and this man walked strode towards me, very angry. And he got within like 4 or 5 feet and he vanished. And if I don't pucker your butt, nothing will.
Yeah, no, that would, no. Now, now that you're describing it, I'm not going to miss it.
Now I can't get Erica to go. That was on the agenda, our next Florida trip. Nope, now she's done. Nope.
Crossed off the list. Well, what made you decide to be a caretaker at a graveyard?
I knew the sexton. He was a fan of the books. And this was during a time when a lot of publishing houses were closing and stuff. And I saw a lot of friends lose their house. So I was like, I don't want to do that. I want to make sure I got a nest egg in the bank. And so he said, hey, well, how would you like to come here? I got an opening for a caretaker. He said, you can come down here, be inspired. And if it went slow, you can write your stories. I said, sold. I get to go down here and play in a cemetery all day and handle dead things and write stories too. I said, yeah. I said, I'd love it. So I did it for almost 8 years. And I've probably, I consider myself a great Native American warrior because I put more white people in the ground than Sitting Bull.
Yes. Yes.
And I've dug up a few too. And that was very fast that you have to dig them up where they were in what they call lawn crypts. So you couldn't bring the vault out of the ground. You couldn't bring the concrete because it was stacked one person on top of the other. So we had to wrap the bodies in plastic and bring them up with the ropes because the wooden caskets had deteriorated. Never bury your loved ones in wood. Always use metal.
Well, so we had mummified if you don't people. Want them to get back up again.
Yeah, I know. You're handing up body parts and legs and stuff like that and hoping the family don't see that because they're standing there watching. You're trying to keep them back or bringing up a mummified man and laying him on the ground. So, yeah, it was fascinating.
Wow. Exhuming bodies. That's always interesting. You hear about that, but you never quite know. So you touched on something. Obviously, you have Native American or Indigenous background.
My father was Cherokee. My mother is Cherokee, Choctaw, and White. Not enrolled, never claimed to be enrolled. Family didn't care about it. My mother and biological father split up before I was born. They had met in Oklahoma. And so she went back to the Midwest and hiding from him for years. She's scared to death of the guy. So yeah. And it's always been something that was taught to me by my grandmother and her side and the family. And I was raised with the legends and the teachings and stuff. So it was something when I started writing at the time, all fantasy and horror mostly had castles in medieval Europe and Dracula and that kind of things. I said, well, why isn't anybody doing anything with the Native American stuff? I mean, people live in this country. Don't they want to know the history? Don't they want to know the beliefs? So I started incorporating it in my stories. That way I was kind of working in some teaching elements. So people not only would be entertained, but they know a history of this, country more than just a history of the European settlements.
Yes. And I have to say, so that's one of the lines in your book. I talked about it on the book club, but it is literally one of my favorite lines in your book. And Crota was when you said, there were two characters were talking to each other and they were discussing that Native Americans didn't have a written language up until X. And he's like, well, where did you hear that? And he goes, well, it's in the history books. And he goes, written by white men. I absolutely love that because I was like, this is so true.
It's true. And the school kids are taught very, very badly about the history of this country and Native Americans. I used to get upset because the only time they ever studied it was around Thanksgiving. And it always showed that textbooks would have a picture of a teepee with an Indian in front of it. I was like, that's only Plains Indians. Yeah. The Indians in the East lived in houses. They live in cabins and stuff, just like anybody else. I said, the Plains Indians live in the teepees because they follow the buffalo. So I used to go into schools and lecture for free because I wanted the kids to know some of the true stories. And I'd walk in and make the teachers mad. I said, I'd be like, I know you kids are studying Native American history, but I'm here to tell you that what you've studied is wrong. And I'm going to tell you the truth. And I never charged for them because, you know, I'm trying to share something that was given to me. So I'd give it to the kids. So that way they have a little bit of knowledge anyway.
No, I think that's fantastic because, again, it's how it's written. We're not even going to get into the conversation about how Florida is rewriting history right now for school-age children. That could be an entire thing in and of itself.
I think we've all had books banned by them now. So.
Yes. I'm just like, woo, I had my book banned in Florida. Go me.
Well, they banned some of the places in Florida banned Ripley's books.
Yeah.
And Ripley's, believe it or not, started has a program for Florida residents where they're giving free copies of their books. Anybody requests one to protest the ban.
Yep.
I think that's brilliant. And, you know, you just, anyway, that's a whole politically agenda thing. But it definitely shows you, even in modern times, how history is being rewritten to fit a narrative. And that is just horrifying when that happens.
Yeah. It is. And, you know, it's a shame because everybody's like, oh, America's 200 years old. It's like, no. There's people been here for thousands of years. And especially Florida's got such a rich Native American history, but nobody down here knows it. Most of the kids, you talk to a high school kid, they have no clue.
Well, the Spanish found it and they saved them. Yeah. And all this, it's like, you know, we named counties after DeSoto and Hernando and all this. It's like, wait a minute, those were bad guys, but whatever.
Well, it's like you go to St. Augustine at the government house, they got this beautiful mosaic tile wall, and it shows the Spanish wading ashore with their crosses and stuff. And it shows a couple of Indians in the front, and the only ones that are kneeling are the Indians. And my policy is, you know why they're kneeling? They're being forced to kneel.
Yes.
It's nobody's kneeling before the cross but them. And I said, this is propaganda right here. When Ponce de Leon landed here searching for the Fountain of Youth, he had to try to land several times because the Indians were shooting arrows at him because they already heard what the bastards the Spanish were.
They knew better. They'd already had a few visitors, and they knew what had happened. And they had word traveled fast from all the stuff that had happened in South America, so they knew.
I know.
Very well aware. Oh, my goodness. Okay, we have to take a quick break. Words from our sponsors, and we will be right back with Owl.
Okay.
Prepare to be devoured. The Wolves of Wharton is a 6-part complete book series by Eerie Travels producer Beau Lake. It has been called dark and visceral, steamy, dramatic, and a fresh take on the werewolf mythos. If you like action, adventure, a large serving of body horror, and some steamy relations, the Wolves of Wharton series is for you. Pick it up wherever books are sold or at linktree.com/Beau_Lake.
Greetings, travelers. Now available on Audible and other audiobook platforms, Eerie Appalachia. Join us, won't you, as we discuss creatures like the Popelik Monster, the White Fangs, the Snallygaster, the Wampus Cat, the Lizard Man of Skateboard Swamp, Bunny Man Bridge, and the Ohio Grassman. All these creatures and more await you if you dare listen to Eerie Appalachia, presented by Mark Muncy, History Press, and Four Horsemen Publishing. And we're back with Al going back. And that in itself is just a pleasure to say. But we touched on before the break, we had touched on your time at Greenwood and some of the things you'd seen. So let's go into a little bit about that. What has been your, what we like to call preternatural? We like to do the Shirley Jackson, where it's just stuff we don't understand yet. Let's talk about some of your background into that. What are some unusual experiences that you would be willing to share with us?
Well, Greenwood, you know, I've heard footsteps. One time I was in the office and nobody else was there. And I was in the boss's office getting a battery for my camera. And I heard footsteps and the door open and close. And I'm like, oh, crap. If I leave the office in a hurry, I'm going to look guilty about something. I wouldn't do anything wrong. And the footsteps come out of the hallway. I said, well, now I can't step out. I'm going to scare the hell out of whoever it is. And the footsteps walked past where I was and there was nobody there. I was like, okay, you know, but as clear as a bell. My wife and I were there on a Sunday one time observing. They had a Confederate Memorial Day. And we're sitting there, and I agreed to babysit the group. They were doing their thing out there in the Confederate section. And clear as a bell, we heard somebody sneeze behind us. And we both turned and looked, and nobody. It was completely empty. There wasn't another soul around. I've seen a large, a beach ball-sized ball of light move through the cemetery. My wife has seen a woman there, you know, that disappeared. I hit with a photographer. We were going up a hill and hit a cold spot. I mean, we were walking up and said, oh, it's getting chilly out. And suddenly it was like icy cold. I'm talking about, you know, it dropped like 30 degrees, 40 degrees, and really frigid. And we stood there, and it faded. And so we walked a little bit farther up the hill, hit it again. So we played with this cold spot for 30 minutes, and it was moving up and down the hill. And we'd find it again, then it would move, and we'd find it again. Last time I was there, they had a ghost tour there. And they had the whole asking the spirits with the flashlight. And I'm watching this lady. She's got a flashlight on the ground. She's asking questions, and this light's flickering. I'm like, okay, all right. You know, this is, you know, I wasn't really buying it. But as I come down the hill, I've always heard stories about shadow people. And I experienced them then. I saw clear as a bell, like 30, 40 people walking in front of me, shadows, in this area near the most haunted area, Greenwood. And my wife was with me, and I'm like, do you see this? And she goes, the shadow people? I'm like, yeah. And we should watch these people in front of, like a little army of spirits. And I said, well, I'm going to go back up in the office. I don't know what they're stirring up out here, but we're going to go back inside. And that was the last time I went out there at nighttime. I wouldn't go out with ghost groups anymore because I think they were upsetting something, but they had definitely stirred up the activity that night.
We had just talked about the Dark Watchers recently in Santa Lucia, California. And I was like, ooh, that sounds very much like them too. So were there like a horde of ghosts?
Well, spirits there like to play pranks too on the caretakers. One time I had with another caretaker, and we pulled up from the barn to the office so he could get a bottle of water. And we had loaded up our hedge trimming equipment and our big 5-gallon metal can of gas. And he comes out of the office and he walks around the back of the cart. He picks up the can of gas. He said, you going to leave this here? I said, I didn't put that there. He goes, well, I didn't. And there's no way this metal can could have fallen 3 feet off the cart to the bricks without us hearing it. But somebody had picked it up and set it out of the cart. And it wasn't like a week later, I'm in one section and I'm marking the grave. I needed my towel to wipe off the marker so I could read it, the little metal numbers they put in the ground. I didn't have any towels. I had left the bucket somewhere and I said, oh crap, you know. And I looked all over the place, looked for a towel and couldn't find one, and got back in the car, backed up, turned around, and it's sitting right there. The bucket is like in a 4-foot bed. There's no way it could not have been there, or I could not have seen it. And I was like, okay, guys, funny. You know, you got to be looking all over the place for a single towel. The bucket's clear as bell. So they liked pranks. You know, stuff would happen out there.
I remember the story I had heard often about there is the guy who built his own mausoleum.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would come and tell people, hey, this is where I'm going to be buried. Isn't it amazing? And then when he did die, he was still there often going up to that mausoleum going, yeah, this is where I built this. This is where I'm buried. It's crazy, isn't it?
Fred Weeks's mausoleum, the backside. Yeah. The full story is he had come down to Florida. He was an Englishman. He came down and bought some property, but it was during a time when they were burning the underbrush in the woods. So when he turns out, he found out he had gotten cheated. They had sold him some swamp land. So he's very unhappy. So he bought a burial space in Greenwood by the front gate, which is now on the backside of the cemetery. And he put the headstone up with his name on it with a saying taken from the Bible about a man who went down to Jericho and fell amongst thieves. And he put the names of the men who ripped him off. Well, they were predominant businessmen in Orlando. They weren't having that. So they bought his space, you know, gave him his money back. But Fred still wasn't happy. He was still ticked off. And he took it to the grave, and he had his little mausoleum built. And on the door of the mausoleum, to the left of the door, he had the same thing carved in. He said, you know, man going out of Jericho and fell amongst thieves and had the names put there. When Fred finally died, they buried him. Somebody came along and carved off the names. So you look at the saying still there, but there's like a little 4-inch square below it where the names originally been built. And that's where I saw the beach ball of light coming from the backside of his mausoleum one night. I watched it for 30 minutes. And I thought it was somebody with a flashlight. And I said, well, then when they step out on the road, I'll see them. Well, when he got to the road, there was nobody there. That happened right around his area.
Wow.
Somebody needs to put those names back. That's all I'm going to say about that.
I want to know who it is too.
Yep. So you mentioned, you know, doing researching cryptids and stuff like that. Have you ever had any of those kind of experiences?
No, I always wanted to. I've got friends who have, close friends, but I never have had experiences. Most unusual story I ever heard was when I owned a bar in Georgia. I had this big redneck come in, and he was drinking, and he was a regular customer. And he started telling me about his experience at Lake Lanier in Macon. They were out bass fishing at night. And he said they heard something in the water, and they turned around, and it's this big, hairy, large creature behind the boat. He had a hold of the boat. And these guys were terrified. They took off the boat heading to shore. This thing was hanging on the back of the boat, slapping the engine out of the water. Now, this man told me the story. He broke down and cried like a baby. He was at least 6'5", 280 pounds. He was a big man. And he cried like a baby. And I offered him $100 to take me out to show him where. He said he would never, ever in his life go out there again. Now, you would think that's just some guy, you know, drunken guy, had a few beers, made up a story. But like a week or two later, the Macon Telegraph and News came out with an article where there had been dozens and dozens of sightings of Sasquatch-type creatures in the swamp on the backside of the Air Force base. And not only individual creatures, but a family unit with young. And these were all sighted by deer hunters. And of course, the question is, why didn't one of the deer hunters shoot them? But you got to remember, if you shoot a deer, you might have to follow it for hours before it dies. You're not going to shoot something 8 feet tall. But they tied in with his story and gave it validity.
That's why we're always about report, 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 because you never know, right? It's one of those we always talk about. Everybody's got that crazy uncle who saw Bigfoot and nobody believes him. But then when you look into it and you find out, oh, there were 7 sightings that same place, same month. Mm-hmm. Wait a minute. Maybe he wasn't crazy. So, and that's...
Well, the gentleman owns Buffalo Bill's shooting store, which is now in Sanford, Florida, told me his story. He was down in a game preserve in South Florida in a tree stand hunting, and he saw one of these creatures come up in the forest and squat down and watch him. So this thing was there like 15, 20 minutes watching him, and he got up and left. So he ran into a female ranger and told her, said, look, I just saw this thing, you know, watched it for 20 minutes. It watched me for 20 minutes. And she said, yeah, we see them all the time, but we're not allowed to talk about them.
Right.
She said, I'll tell you what, I'm getting off here at 5 o'clock. Why don't you swim back by and we can talk and compare notes. So she went into the office and her boss was there. And she said, yeah, I just ran into a guy. He saw another one. I'm going to meet up with him. We're going to talk. And the boss was like, no, you're not. You're not going back out here and telling him anything. So this guy, you know, never met up with her. And he ran into her at a different game preserve like a year or two later. He said, hey, remember me? You know, we're supposed to talk to you. And she said, no. She said, my boss wouldn't let me go out that day. In fact, they transferred me because I actually admitted that there was such things.
Yeah.
I mean, the Rangers know they're there, but they're not allowed to talk about them.
We hear that a lot. That's why so many will send us anonymous letters that aren't anonymous, but we have to present them as anonymous.
Well, I mean, that kind of makes sense. And from a national parks, a person is smart, people are stupid. So you'd either get everybody too terrified to go to the national parks, or you get the crazy idiots that would be out there with their guns and stuff on the hunt for them.
Look at all those, you know, when Mothman, Frogman, and Flatwoods Monster all made the newspapers, people swarmed the towns.
Going back to Georgia, I was stationed at Robins Air Force Base in Warner Robins last year of service. And it's a SAC base. We had nuclear bombers. And a friend of mine, Willie, was on the base on the flight line, and he's walking on the back road. And he said he was walking, it was nighttime, his shift, and he's walking, and he looks to his right, and there's a man walking next to him, come out of nowhere. And the guy's like talking to him. Willie's like, oh, where'd this guy come from? And kind of getting an eerie feeling. And he swears he looked down, and the guy's feet weren't touching the ground. So now he's really scared because it's nighttime, he's by himself out there on the flight line, and he just looked straight ahead. When he looked back, the guy was gone. Now, you think it's his imagination, but the security police, by the time, swarmed Willie. They showed up in several vehicles. They go, where did the guy go? And they had seen him, too, and was watching what was going on. And they took Willie in and kept him for interrogation for 6 hours, trying to figure out what was going on, because they had all saw this weird, mysterious guy, creature, whatever it was, next to Willie, out there where the bombers and stuff were. So it was an interesting story. We don't know whether it was alien, creature, ghost, or what, but they all saw it.
Yep.
And of course, he was the one who got in trouble for it.
Yep. And that's one of those, I'm sure if you do a Freedom of Information Act for that day, everything is redacted. Yep. There'll be no, it'll just be a nothing, big black sheet of paper and say Thursday. I've got so many of those on file now, it's not even funny. All right. So you've got tons of stories. You are full of stories, and we literally could go all night, just you and me sharing Florida stories. If you had one thing that you could sit there and go, this is the thing I want to talk to, this is the thing I want to experience, what is that? What is your bucket list item there? So
that's really a hard question because there's so many. I mean, you know, there's so many haunted places I would like to go and just find out information about. I mean, I want to know who built Stonehenge and why. I want to know who built the pyramids and why. I know the Egyptians, but I'm not convinced that they were built for burial chambers because there's no markings on the inside. All the other tombs are lavishly decorated. Just these great mysteries that are, that haven't been solved over the years, lost civilizations and stuff. I mean, I'm fascinated by everything. It's hard to put on just one thing I like to investigate. The stories of the little people. You're up there in North Carolina. They got legends of little people in the Bald Mountains where they supposedly held their ceremonies. Franklin County, North Carolina, supposedly has caves that are man-made. They're too small for humans, and they're supposed to be the homes of the little people where they found small tools. Just things like that. I just want to research it. Probably I'd love to find out what happened to the giants that were uncovered along St. John's River here in Florida. I mean, in the 1800s, where they found the 8-foot skeletons with the double row of teeth with the skulls big enough that the guys are putting them on their heads, wearing them for helmets to play around. I mean, it was covered by the newspapers, but every single one of the skeletons have vanished, and not a single museum in the country admit to having one.
Yep. Been talking about that, the mounds up in West Virginia. When I grew up, it was in my history book that they found a 12-foot skeleton with a spear that was as big as it and all this in it. And the Smithsonian came and took it. So when I wrote the Smithsonian and said, hey, what about some of these giant skeletons? Like, what are you talking about? We have no idea. And I'm like, here's the newspaper article. The day you guys were there. Nope, wasn't us. That's yellow journalism.
Exactly.
Really?
I mean, the Indians along the river called them the tall man. They knew about the village. And that's when you get into folklore. It's like one thing to have a folklore where you can tell us a legend where they interweave teachings for little kids. But there's another, you come across, oh yeah, just in that lake, there's a monster. Stay away from it. Where the Indians will tell you, or stay away from this water monster, or this has been seen. And it's a lot up in North Carolina, Tennessee like that. And it's like, okay, wait a minute. This may not be folklore. This is done as a warning to keep somebody getting from eaten by something. And that's always a fascinating, you backtrack that and try to do the research.
Well, it's interesting. Here. We were talking about that actually. And the fact that, you look at alligators and stuff, there are reasons to tell people not to go in lakes, and not because of some mystical whatever, right? There are legitimate things that are bad that still exist as far as like documented nature. Catfish that can eat an entire person.
Exactly. Yeah. I talked to a Lakota friend of mine, and we're talking about Walking Sam, which is a story that takes place on Pine Ridge about this suicide god, or a very tall figure like Slender Man. And all these young people have committed suicide. And a lot of them say that they blame it on Walking Sam. They were influenced by him. And I was talking about stuff like that to him, and his comments were, this guy knows a lot of things. And he was like, well, there's doors all the time open that never get closed. So I'm like, yeah, that's a pretty good answer. Stuff gets open from and comes from somewhere else and is here for a while and gets stuck here.
I actually said that one of the things that one of our listeners wrote in about was this thing called the Boone Devil. And apparently the story goes, and Mark, correct me if I say this wrong, but the story goes that this thing was summoned by Native Americans to get rid of this Daniel Boone fort in the white men, basically, right? And so this thing lives on this property that belongs to this one listener who wrote in. And I go, there's these things where they do this stuff, like summon something, but there's no ETA, like do A, B, or C. And then this is how long you're here. They're just like, well, we summoned it. It's there. You can't just leave stuff.
Like, and then that one, we got a follow-up from some college professor in the nearby town said, that can't be real because it's one of those, I live in that area. I've never heard that story. I can't believe it, blah, blah, blah. And it was like, you guys really got to stop reading these unedited and all this. And
then the next facts.
Yeah. But the next email I got like 10 minutes later was from another person in the area going, thank goodness somebody else wrote about this because I thought I was the only one who knew this story. I thought we were the only family that talked about it. We live in the same valley. We're just right over the ridge. And it was like, okay, so now we've got a conflicting stories, but I love that because that means there's some meat on those bones there. We've got to dig into that. So
yeah.
Well, so many people never go out in the woods. They don't leave their house at night. I mean, I love to sit outside at nighttime and I'll see none of the neighbors. It's like, how can you see anything if you're inside your house watching TV all the time? I mean, the people who are seeing this stuff is the people who are actually venturing in the deep forest or camping out or backpacking, hiking, whatever. And they have the experience and everybody says, no, you didn't. Well, how do you know? Unless you go there and look for yourself.
It's true. I want to talk because you brought up skinwalkers. And one of the things is people keep saying skinwalker is a very generic term discussing everything that maybe changes shape. I mean, it's a skinwalker. This is a skinwalker. And I'm like, no, that's not how that works.
Well, all the original stories I've heard of skinwalkers all came from the Navajo culture.
Right.
And they were witches. There was not something good. I mean, we've attached shapeshifters and now we use it, mixing back and forth shapeshifters and skinwalkers. But all the original skinwalker legends I've heard come from out in the Southwest. And people still to this day very much believe in skinwalkers. And it's not something you talk about. I mean, it's just kind of like, okay, you know, somebody might be listening or, you know, and they're usually not good things to encounter on a dark and lonely road.
It's another one of those also weird that it, you know, the more you say it, the more likely you're getting its attention kind of thing. You know, it's you're invoking it again, like our tulpas that, you know, intention's going to bring it about. And that's why we know the Cherokee don't like to use that word because it's a Navajo word. So yeah. they just use shifting or wampus, you know, the wampus cats and stuff like that. And the wolf woman or the deer woman, those kind of things. And they're very specific to their culture. And that's one of the reasons we bring it up is because it's one of those, everything's a skinwalker. No. It's like, you know, in some of the paranormal shows, everything's a demon. No. You know, it's
we're not going to call out who says that.
There are other things.
Some of the cultures don't even like using the name of the deceased because they think the ghost will come back. If you're going to use it, then you end up giving a child that name of grandpa and grandma. And it's okay to say that name, but they're scared to say it out loud. I had a guy named William Sanders, fellow writer, Cherokee writer, who's dead now. And I had a staff that had some really weird powers to it. It was given to me. It was carved by a man in Vietnam. And I sent it, you know, started talking to him, and he didn't want to hear about it. He's like, quit talking about it. Don't send me a picture of it. This is the last time. He was scared just hearing about the staff because some weird properties associated. He kept going, get rid of it, bury it. I'm like, no, but it looks cool. And it was like hand carved by a guy nicknamed Walking Death, who carved it with a bayonet before he died. And his staff, the top of it looked like an Easter Island head. And it had an open mouth. And you put it through your ears, you hear the damn thing talking. And I took two hawk feathers, a medicine pouch, wrapped it in red velvet, or red felt, with cord every 2 inches. I wrapped a string around it, put it in an army blanket, wrapped that up, put it in my shed. I checked it 2 months later when I unwrapped it. The feathers were gone. The medicine pouch was gone, but it's still wrapped. So we don't know why it disappeared. And that's when I decided, okay, all the good stuff I put on it disappeared. It's time to get rid of this damn thing. But yeah, they didn't even want me to talk about it. It's like, don't send us a picture. No, we don't want this coming to our house.
That's me with the creepy dolls that places keep sending me. And I take them over to Erica's.
No, you don't. I have a very nicely protected house. Thank you anyway with your weird haunted object thing.
Well, I got a cat in my living room. It had dead people in it, and I shouldn't have that. But it's like, okay, it was a gift from a guy I like, so it'd be an insult not to accept it.
Through that.
Accept it and then go put it in a plexiglass box locked away somewhere. Oh, my gosh. Well, outside of Jaws, which is dutifully terrifying, and I agree, has there ever been anything as you've started to research that you were like, nope, I'm leaving this completely alone?
No, but I'm an idiot. I mean, as a native person, I know I shouldn't go around cemeteries, burial grounds, haunted places. But as a horror writer, I go around cemeteries, burial grounds, and haunted places, even when I know better. It takes a lot of purification before and afterwards, and I get in a lot of trouble doing this. But yeah, there's so far there's nothing I won't mess with. I avoid, you know, the occult, and you know, I'm not going to sit there when somebody's doing a devil ceremony or something. But yeah, I go around places and I'll research anything. I may avoid stuff. When I was at a convention one time, they had a voodoo priestess come in and do a ceremony. And I was the guy backing up across the room, put my back against the wall so I can get the hell out of there in a hurry. And everybody was looking at me because they knew I was going to back across the room, put my back against the wall. So like, no, no, voodoo ceremonies. I know what's going on, but I'm going to be protected.
Don't mess with the Loa. Don't mess with the Loa. Oh my gosh.
Now, I do avoid my Ouija. I do have an Ouija board. I don't like using it. I started to use it with my granddaughter to show her. It answered a couple of questions and I didn't like the answer because it scared the hell out of me. And I put it up real quick. That's that. We're not playing with this thing no more.
That is an absolute nope for Erica. I will not, under any circumstances, have a Ouija board or be around people playing with Ouija boards. You have no idea the portals you can open doing that.
Even if they're produced by Parker Brothers?
I don't give a crap because yeah, it's the intention. That's the thing about Ouija boards to me. And it's kind of like, I feel like when you go ghost hunting, you're like hoping to find something there, right? But if you go do certain things, you're asking to summon things there. Like with Ouija boards, you're asking for something to come talk to you. And there's not a lot on how those filters work on exactly what you've asked to come visit you. And I'm like, I'm okay. I had an experience when I was a teenager and I went, nah, never, ever, ever, ever again. There was a story I heard one time. I think it was on another podcast. And this person had written in and talked about how they had done something like that. And whatever was talking to them was really, they tried to burn the Ouija board and it wouldn't burn. It was a Parker Brothers Ouija board and they couldn't get it. They had it in the middle of the fire and it wouldn't burn. And I'm like, no, thank you.
Child safety laws come against them there. So because they had to be protected from burning. But anyway, oh my gosh, this has been amazing. We have had so much fun with this. Oh my gosh.
Okay. Well, you got to ask Al a final question, Mark.
Yeah, my final question, Al, for you then is what's next?
Old age, death, reincarnation. I think pretty much in that order. I mean,
you're not going to go for, you know, emeritus on Bram Stoker Award?
Yeah. I think, yeah, so that's what I'm looking forward to, haunting my family and a few other people, you know. It's kind of something, you know, it's a lifelong goal. Plugging away with the writing, I just finished a new novel set during the Civil War, and it takes place in a huge cemetery. I wanted to do it because it's early days of the Civil War. And what I'm reading and what I've researched on that period is very, very sounding very similar to what's going on in this country right now. I mean, the attitude and stuff. It's really terrifying when you think about that, how back then nobody would have discussions anymore. They yell and scream. And nobody would see the other person's side, either political, and the state's dividing. And we're getting into that situation again. So I wanted to do something about that. More, you know, entertainment, but I also try to work in a little teaching too. So maybe more of a warning than, you know, just a regular book.
Love it. I'm in. I got my pre-order done now.
Of course, we will end up with copies, all of us, and we'll have to have it as one of our book clubs because that's something we do on our Discord for all of our travelers, for those out there. Join our Discord and you can join our book club and you'll get to read amazing books like Crota and then be terrified and not be able to sleep in the dark. So it's fine. It's all good. It's all good. Nothing like living on a mountain when you read a book like that. Cause cool. Yeah. So where can people find you? What is the best way to reach out and find your work and maybe interact with you on social media?
I've got a website. They can email me from there. I am on Twitter occasionally. I mean, you know, it's like Twitter's like a grain of salt nowadays. It's changing. I do have a Facebook page. So yeah, I'm out there. I don't do social media as much as I did before because, you know, everybody's gotten crazy and cranky on it. But I am available. They can, you know, find me on the website, algoingback.com. And if they want to contact me, send me an email from there.
Awesome.
Books are on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, eBay, some crappy garage sales, things like that. You can find my books in spot anywhere.
Are you still doing any conventions?
I am. I'm doing Spooky Empire in Orlando in October and also Necronomicon in Tampa in September, I believe.
Nice. Two of our old stomping grounds. Sadly, we're missing both those this year because we're doing.
Yeah, shame on you for moving away. You know, we miss you guys.
It's what we wanted to be up here and Tennessee, North Carolina to study the monsters a little closer. I've studied a ton of Florida. Now it's time to move, stretch my legs a little bit. So,
like, you could find anything up there. It could beat Florida man. Seriously.
No, that's true. No, Florida man wins, period. And I don't think I'm ever going to find anything that beats the Barton Booger. But
we are sure going to try.
We're going to try.
What that means is our travelers, you can travel to both of those conventions and get a signed copy and meet the amazing Al Going Back in person, which I highly, highly recommend doing. He is an amazing, wonderful person. And his wife is even better. And she's usually with him. So I'm going to just throw that out there.
She's much better.
Her fry bread wins every award ever, period.
I knew Mark was going to somehow bring up the fry bread.
If she gets on British Bake Off, American Bake Off, whatever, whatever the ingredients are, she makes fry bread and it's over. Everybody's done. Gordon Ramsay quits. That's how it's going to be.
Oh my goodness. Okay. Well, Mark, why don't you wrap us up here, my friend?
All right. Well, Al, thank you so much again for joining us. This has been a pleasure. Long time coming. We've been needing to do this for a while, and I'm so glad we got to. And we will, for you travelers at home, please do us a favor. Go out, pick up one of Al's books. They're around. They're available everywhere. And enjoy the amazing storytelling of this great award-winning author. And listen to stories. Listen to stories always. And listen to the stories that are passed around the fire. Listen to the stories of your family, your friends, and listen to the stories of your ancestors, and listen to the stories around you. And then go out, look out your window, and make your own stories. And we'll see you on the other side.